Is it true that a rabbi past 100 years old in Israel had a revelation of Jesus, Yeshua? And is there prophetic significance to the death of Ariel Sharon, or are these just contemporary myths?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, it is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. I am sitting in Dallas, Texas, well, right near Dallas, Texas, teaching all day today, tomorrow, and Saturday at the King's University, teaching on prophetic ministry and our calling to confront the culture with the truth of God. And we've scheduled my teaching day around radio so I could be with you live. The number is always 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. We're going to have a very fascinating conversation with an author who's written a book about a rabbi who finds the Messiah that somehow ties in with the death of Ariel Sharon. I've heard a lot on different sides of this issue, and I am going to be the polite devil's advocate raising questions for Pastor Carl Gallups to prove his point. He's researched this. I know there are many challenges to what he has to say, so we're going to have a fascinating journey. If you want to call in along the way, I will take some calls, 866-34-TRUTH. Carl Gallups, welcome to The Line of Fire.
Dr. Brown, thank you so much. What an honor to be with you. And listen, I welcome the approach that you're going to take today. God bless you for that.
Oh, absolutely. I could do nothing less for many reasons, and I know you've researched this topic. Just to get to know you a little bit better, how is it that you end up with this focus or interest at all? What drew you into this question about an elderly rabbi? He dies well past the age of 100 years old. Jewish mysticism, not a name that would be known in Christian circles. General Yitzhak Kaduri, how do you get drawn into all of this? And what are your qualifications in writing the book about the rabbi who found the Messiah?
Yes, well, thank you so much. Well, I have been in ministry. I've been senior pastor for 27 years of a church down here on the Gulf Coast, a Baptist church near Pensacola, and 27 years there, over 30 years in ministry. So my whole goal in life is to advance the kingdom of Jesus Christ across the world and to declare the contextual word of God in truth. And I'm the founder of the P.P. Simmons News and Ministry Network on the internet with millions and millions of viewers and hundreds of thousands of readers and subscribers. I've got a radio program been doing for 12 years. So all you know, examining current events and connected to the Word of God, and even as connected to prophecy, biblical prophecy. So that's my background: Bible teaching, preaching, and Bible ministry to the world, similar to yours in that fashion. But as far as me getting interested in the story, you're absolutely right. Prior to something happening in 2007. I knew very little about this man, but in 2007, his so-called death note, and we'll discuss that in more detail, I'm sure, was reported on by Israel Today, and I'm a reader of Israel Today, and by News First Class, which is now called News One out of Israel, as you know, Hebrew-only edition of news reporting. But these two Israeli-based news organizations reported that this rabbi, Yitzhak Kaduri, had died and had been dead a year, and a note that he had left proclaiming the quote, the real name of the Messiah. He had met the Messiah in a vision, he said. That note was posted on his website, kaduri.net, and then was reported on by these Israeli news organizations. And the note was there for some time. I don't know exactly how long, but probably some weeks, until the note was decoded. It was written in kind of encrypted fashion, and once it was decoded, it had been determined that this famous rabbi declared that Jesus was the name of the Messiah. That's how I got interested in it.
All right. So you heard about it the way a lot of the rest of the Christian world did. This has been hotly disputed. Orthodox rabbi emailed me earlier today. Look at a video that disputes this or says it's not true. We're going to talk about it when we come back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to The Line of Fire on this thoroughly Jewish Thursday. My guest, Pastor Carl Gallups, has written a book about the rabbi who found the Messiah. Is it true that Rabbi Yitzchak Kaduri, revered among ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel and beyond, one of the great scholars of Jewish mysticism of his generation, Jewish mysticism being a very esoteric, difficult Jewish study subject. Is it true that he had a revelation of the Messiah and identified him as Yehoshua Jesus? Is it true that it ties in with the death of Ariel Sharon? Or is this, again, just a contemporary myth? There are videos online of Orthodox rabbis, lawyers, saying this is all false, this is a forgery, there is no such letter, no such prophecy. Other religious Jews saying this is ridiculous, no one in the Christian world ever heard of this man before, now they're all hailing him as a great rabbi. He did not believe in Jesus, Yeshua, and this is just more date setting that will prove to be false. These are some of the obstacles that Pastor Carl Gallups had to overcome in writing his book, The Rabbi Who Found the Messiah. And if you read the reviews on Amazon, you'll find a ton of excellent reviews of people who love the book. And then you'll find some who absolutely reject it and say it's wrong. So Pastor Carl, when you became aware of this, and you say this was an official website of Rabbi Kaduri, kaduri.net, did you hear any disputing claims? And we'll talk about the exact nature of what was found in a moment and this cryptic message. But did you hear claims from his sons or from others saying it's not true, it's a forgery? What's the history of this from your investigation?
Oh, yes, Dr. Brown. As a matter of fact, my book is not wrong because my book is written from a journalistic, objective standpoint. I just tell the story. I don't jump up and down. It's not preachy. I'm not an apologist for this rabbi. I don't proclaim that the rabbi is a modern-day prophet and everything he spoke is true. I simply tell the story that's out there from an investigative journalist standpoint. So,
and by the way, it's selling. It looks like it's selling like hotcakes these days, especially since the death of Sharon.
Well, listen, the first printing's already sold out. It's already into its second printing, and they just can't keep them printed quickly enough. So, yeah, it's going crazy all over the world. Plus, the book was made into a documentary DVD. And what I'd like to do is to assure your listeners I'm a solid, conservative, contextual Bible teacher and preacher. I have that reputation for 30 years. I don't set dates. I never have. I'm not some nut that's out here proclaiming that this rabbi is the savior of the world and he had a vision that we must all get ready, put on white sheets, and go to a mountaintop and get ready now. That's not me at all, and that's not the book.
So this is not your fifth or sixth book setting dates, and all the last ones haven't happened, so now you're up to your new one.
No. I have never done that. I have a solid ministry, 27 years in one church, a large church. My people know me. I preach all over the world. I've been on several continents of the world preaching to tens of thousands. As I said, got millions of followers and viewers on the Internet. Folks know that I'm solid as a rock. And what I've done, I've taken this story because it needed to be told, because the media, the Orthodox Jewish media buried it, the mainstream media buried it. Once it was revealed what this Messiah was what this rabbi was purported to have said about the Messiah. But I want to address some of the objections. Now, by the way, my book deals very objectively. I address the objections. I deal with them. I report them. This book has been made into a documentary movie by award-winning film producer George Escobar and WND Films. And I got to address this, Dr. Brown. In the movie, we have film footage of students of Rabbi Kaduri's yeshiva. As you and your listeners know, that's a rabbinical training school. And these students are not 20-year-old kids. These are 40, 50, 60-year-old men putting their legacies and lives on the line. They're on film proclaiming that Rabbi Kaduri not only left a note, but he told them he was leaving a note. Not only that, but for years before he died, he was teaching in his yeshiva that Messiah's name was Yeshua. Not only that, but two of these guys are on film saying that they gave their lives to Jesus Christ as Lord as a result of this rabbi teaching this in his yeshiva. Not only now, that.
Yeah, hang on. Let me just jump in and say one thing. I am 100% sure to the core of my being that in the coming days, and I can't give dates, but certainly as we get closer and closer to the return of Yeshua, whenever that is, that more and more ultra-Orthodox Jews will be turning to him. I know a few. Over the years, I've met a few genuine ultra-Orthodox believers. I've heard from them about many others they know. But years ago, there was a report from a woman that there were 400 Orthodox rabbis in Israel who believed, and the report was bogus. The report was bogus. This woman herself doesn't even follow Jesus. And yet I have no question that these types of things would be happening. I've expected it for years and years and years. So there's nothing in me that would be in the least bit skeptical. So as I'm playing the devil's advocate, I'm doing it because I know there are questions out there and because I know you've taken this seriously and you've done your homework. But I want to reiterate to you and to my listeners, this is the kind of thing I fully expect. Again, I've met people here and there, not hundreds. It's smaller numbers. Some have told me about many, many others that they know who are secret believers. But I fully expect God to be opening hearts, opening minds, and we'll flesh out exactly what this note said in the moment. But you were talking about not only having documentation of the authenticity of this, but eyewitness testimony from people who are close to him. Because there are others, you know, sons and say it never happened, he didn't write it, it's a forgery. You're saying there were students of his who verify it.
Oh, yes. We've got them transcripted in my book, but we've got them on film for you to see and hear and witness yourself in the movie. And not only that, as I was saying, but one of these students actually says just what you were saying, that there are many, he says, his words, there are many, many Jews in Israel who are believers in Yeshua, but they are terrified to say so publicly because of the vast amount of persecution that they would take. And so, but not only that, but when this note, this purported note, which he told many people, including his students, when it was posted on Kaduri's website, kaduri.net, Israel Today ran stories on it, News First Class. I think some of the Kaduri people and some of these lawyers are forgetting that we're living in the information age where we have something called the Wayback Machine and Google and the Internet. And so they're out there denying that it ever happened. But you can go on the Internet and see it with your own eyes. These Israeli news sources did it. And there it is. And it was on the website. And so somebody from within his organization posted this note. And as a matter of fact, Dr. Brown, the only time the note was taken down is when it was finally decoded and determined that the name he had left was, in fact, Yeshua. Then they took it down. Then they said that it was a hoax. But prior to that, they were quite proud to have it up on the website.
All right. When you say decode it, of course, looking at it, reading it, once you understand what it's saying, it's pretty self-evident. But explain what was said. We've got 2 minutes before the break, so let's just get this part in. Okay. What did the note actually say, and then what's the decoding of it?
Okay, let me give the 2 minute explanation quickly. The note said it was all in Hebrew, but I'm going to say it in English. All the note said was concerning the letter abbreviation of his name, and of course he was talking about the Messiah because he said he was going to leave the Messiah's name. Concerning the letter abbreviation of his name, comma, he shall lift his people and show that his word and his law are valid. Now, that note is rather innocuous. It sounds very Hebrew. It sounds very Old Testamentish. So it was put up on the website, and it was proclaimed. Here's Kaduri's note. Everything was cool until people realized that, you know, he said he was giving us the name of the Messiah. So they looked at it. Now, this old rabbi was steeped in Kabbalah and mysticism. So they said, you know what? He's left it in code. And so they looked at his clue concerning the letter abbreviation of his name, comma. And then what was left was written in six Hebrew words. When you took the first letter of each of those six Hebrew words, the letter abbreviations of them, it spelled out perfectly in Hebrew, Yehoshua, or that's the long form of Yeshua, or Yeshua, which of course in English we would say Jesus. When they saw that, once they understood what he had done and what was left, that's when they pulled the note down. That's when they said it was a hoax. And what's amazing, I've got film footage in the movie of David Kaduri, his son, saying, "My father never even talked about the Messiah." Well, that's not true, because the Israeli media reported for years, every time Kaduri opened his mouth about Messiah, and the coming of Messiah and for the Jews to return to Israel because if Messiah was on his way, it's in the media. Plus, we've got his students saying he taught this for years. So there are, I believe, in my humble opinion, some nefarious reasons why they would say this, but the facts just don't line up with their story.
All right, my guest, full of passion, and I'm thrilled to hear this passion, Pastor Carl Gallups. The book is The Rabbi Who Found Messiah, The Story of Yitzhak Kaduri and His Prophecies of the End Time. Carl Gallups, that's G-A-L-L-U-P-S. If you're out there listening and you feel that you can dispute any of this, please, please call. The phone lines are open, wide open.
The coffin of a national hero wrapped in the flag. Ariel Sharon was in so many ways the embodiment of Israel. Its rights and its wrongs, its hopes and its fears.
All right, Ariel Sharon's death. What in the world does this have to do with the words of Rabbi Yitzhak Kaduri and, according to my guest, Pastor Carl Gallups, his prediction or his identification of Yehoshua, therefore Yeshua, Jesus, as the Messiah? Pastor Gallups, there's some calls I do want to take and interact with some others as well, but let's keep laying foundations now as we're talking. You say that there is documentation that Rabbi Kaduri often spoke about the Messiah. You document that in your book, correct?
Yes, I do, and in the movie, yes.
Okay. How can they get the DVD?
The movie and the book are both the same name, under the same title, The Rabbi Who Found Messiah. Amazon is the quickest and easiest way, but you can get them at Lifeway bookstores, Books a Million, Barnes & Noble, anywhere where good books are sold. You can go to WND Publishers, WND Books, and get them. But the title is The Rabbi Who Found Messiah by Carl Gallups, and just go to Amazon, put my name in, and there it is, the book and the movie. You can get them both there. The movie
Great.
Is
okay.
about an hour long.
Got it. All right, so is there a claim that you have come across that he said that the Messiah appeared to him or something like that?
Yes. Yes. There are several claims, and it's documented in my book and in the movie, that he said that he had a visitation, a vision of Messiah. Messiah appeared to him, and he knew the name of Messiah and would leave that name in a note. But as I've pointed out, he was already declaring the name of Messiah in his yeshiva, but it was to a smaller group of people, kind of privately. And if he did really believe this, and we know the persecution he would have taken, so I think that if he really left this note, it was a brilliant way to do it. He was the most revered rabbi in the last 100 years in Israel, and to pique everybody's curiosity by saying, I've got a note a year after I'm dead, open it, and then it's open. Now the whole world, Dr. Brown, is talking about it 8 years later. So that was a brilliant plan, if indeed it was his.
And what's the best guesstimate as to how old he was when he died?
108 is the best guesstimate. Some have him at 116, but probably 108 is about the best age range.
Yeah, all extraordinary. And then again, the world of Jewish mysticism is all the more forbidding to outsiders. So the whole story becomes more complex.
Yes.
And then just give us again the short version, because I want to unpack these things. What in the world does this have to do with the death of Ariel Sharon? He's been in a coma, for 8 years?
Yeah.
And now he dies.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me. It's an amazing story. Here's the deal in a nutshell. Again, my book goes into the nitty-gritty details. In fall of 2005, Kaduri proclaimed two shocking things, Dr. Brown. Number one, shocking thing number one, he had met the Messiah, he knew his name, and he was leaving his name in a death note 1 year after his death. That was shocking thing number one. Shocking thing number two, in fall of 2005, he said that it had been revealed to him that the coming of this Messiah was connected to the death of Ariel Sharon, that Messiah would not come until Sharon died. Now, when he spoke those things, Dr. Brown, both he and Sharon were living and in good health, as far as anyone knew. Sharon was the 11th prime minister of Israel. But watch this. Within weeks, just a handful of weeks, Sharon suffered a stroke in December, He kind of recovered from that. But January 4th, 2006, he suffered another stroke and went into a coma. January 28th of 2006, the same month, Kaduri died. So people saw this and they freaked out. They said, oh my gosh, within weeks of him saying these two shocking things, Sharon is in a coma, Kaduri is dead. Well, in January 2007, the note was open and it was posted on his website. By March or April, Israeli news sources were running pictures of the note and were running stories about the note. Then the note was decoded, and it was discovered that he left the name Yeshua as Messiah. Well, that's when the Orthodox Jewish world and the media shut it down and started claiming it was a hoax. Well, then prophecy watchers began watching the life of Ariel Sharon, and he stayed in a coma. 1 year passed, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years. At the seven-year mark, January 2013, Fox News was running major stories that Ariel Sharon's brainwaves were displaying normal activity. In fact, some people were speculating he might even wake up. Then, on January the 1st, 2014, notice all these January dates, January the 1st, 2014, we wake up to international news headlines, Ariel Sharon is on his way out and will die any day. On January the 11th, exactly 8 years and 7 days, on the Sabbath, on a Saturday, he passes. A few days later, they do his funeral, and there's an earthquake in Israel in the middle of his funeral. It's just amazing, amazing stuff. By the way, Yitzhak Kaduri died on a Sabbath day as well in 2006. So all of these connections are amazing. The Januaries, think about it, January 2006, Sharon goes in a coma, Kaduri dies. January 2007, the note is posted. January 2013, Sharon's brainwaves are active. January 2014, it's announced he will die. January 2014, he does die, and the day of his funeral, there's an earthquake in Israel. So just amazing, amazing correlations, and people are paying attention. But it's giving me an opportunity to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ and the prophetic days in which we live, regardless of whether this story is 1,000% authentic or not. But I just report what is already in the news, and we play devil's advocate in the book, and I examine all the objections.
Yep. Awesome. My guest, Pastor Carl Gallups, his book, The Rabbi Who Found Messiah, he said, written from a journalist's perspective. So, by the way, I'm away. I knew about the book, but I'm away, could not get the book in time. So I'm eager to read it myself. If I was listening, I'd be getting online to order it. We're not selling the book right now, but get online, order a copy, and check things out. I'm eager. They better send me the DVD also. Told me to need the book. Matt, make sure we get the DVD also. I want to watch this. And next half hour, I'm going to be taking calls. In fact, I'm going to go straight to the calls when we come back. And again, this much I'm sure of. I have no question about the fact that God is sovereignly revealing himself to Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox Jews, just as he is to Muslims around the world. I have no question about that, and that he's revealing Yeshua. No question. And this has been fascinating to me. Now, I have Messianic friends in Israel who studied this carefully, and they say they're sure it's true, that they're sure the story is true, and that he had this revelation. And I've seen interviews with some of the students. And then, of course, there are others, Orthodox lawyers, say it's not true, the whole thing's a sham. Somebody's not accurate here, and here we have a man who has studied the evidence and wants you to study it as well. All right, friends, remember, just a few more days to order my Authentic Fire book. When you get it, you get a free ebook. It's a mini book, over 25,000 words. It's some of the best, most important writing I've ever done on these issues of real revival, the real moving of the Spirit. So call now, 1-800-278-9978, 1-800-278-9978, to order your copy of Authentic Fire. When you do, you'll be told how you can get the free ebook as well. We'll be right back with a whole lot more.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday with our Thoroughly Jewish subject. Did Rabbi Yitzchak Kaduri, one of the most revered rabbis in modern Israel, an expert in Jewish mysticism, well past 100 years old when he died, did he meet with the Messiah? Did he reveal that his name was Yehoshua, Jesus? And are there students of his that say, yes, he actually told us about Yeshua, Jesus? My guest, Carl Gallups, has reported it in a best-selling book right now, The Rabbi Who Found Messiah. Carl, great to have you with us on the air. Thanks so much for joining us. I want to grab a call or two, and I want to share some interesting stories as well, but let's go to Matthew in Broad Run, Virginia. Thanks so much for calling the Line of Fire.
No problem. How are you doing, Dr. Brown?
Doing very well, thanks.
Great. I want to share a story about Kaduri. God sent me to Israel back in 98, and during Matzot, I went down to the Western Wall, and I pulled my tallit out, and I got down, and I started to pray on my knees, and I felt something on my elbow, and I looked up, and there was this old man. And he said to me, we don't pray like that here. And I said to him, I said, how is it that the prophet, when he came in the presence of God, he fell on his face? And the prophet said he couldn't speak because he had unclean lips, and they took coal and put it to his mouth before he could utter a word before God. How is it that you and I can stand before God and pray? And he patted me on the back, and he went and grabbed a chair and came, and he sat down next to me. He finished praying, sitting down, and I sat there, and I was just overwhelmed and overjoyed that this elderly man would do that, and I prayed that the Messiah would reveal himself to him, and then I found out 2 days later who that was, and that was Rabbi Kaduri, and I was just floored by it, and I thank God for allowing me the opportunity, you know, to pray that, and then to find out that 7 years later, he revealed himself to him. You know, praise the Lord.
How did you find out it was him? Who told you that?
I saw a something with during Matzot, and it showed the chief rabbinic, and it would show Kaduri in the paper. And I asked somebody, I said, who is this man? And they said, that's Rabbi Kaduri. He's one of the greatest Kabbalists of ever. And I said, oh, okay. I met him the other day.
All right. All right. That, friends, that is a testimony. I'm taking the call and hearing it as you are. So if you say, can I verify every detail? I have no reason to think Matthew made the story up. So he has just reported something to you. Looking at one call here, I believe someone wants to challenge some of this. So this is great. We'll get to
Yes.
have you lay out the expertise that you have behind your research, Pastor
Yes.
Gallups. But just tell us, give us a minute highlight about one of the students and what you have on this DVD.
Yeah, well, one of the students proclaims that he was a part of the training school, the yeshiva. The guy looks to be in his 50s, probably. Lord, forgive me if he's younger. But he looks to be in his 50s, and he's speaking in Hebrew. It has to be translated. He's thoroughly Hebrew, born and raised in Israel. Studying in the rabbinical training school, and he is adamant that Kaduri taught about Messiah and taught that Messiah's name was Yeshua. He said Kaduri wasn't giving invitations and wasn't proclaiming that you needed to be, quote, saved. He was saying the name, the Messiah, is Yeshua. He said he then took the scriptures based upon all of Kaduri's teaching, went through the Old Testament, and came to his own realization that Yeshua was Messiah, gave his life to Jesus Christ, began studying the New Testament documents, and understood how they lined up with the prophecies of the Old Testament. That's all on film in our movie.
All right, remember, you can get this by going to Amazon.com and ordering The Rabbi Who Found Messiah, Carl Gallups. Get the book and the DVD. Study it for yourself.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
My guest, Pastor Carl Gallups, on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, as I come your way live from Dallas, Texas, where I'm here doing an intensive three-day class for the King's University, one of the four seminaries where I serve as a professor, along with my home school, Fire School of Ministry. He's let our listening audience know he's been in pastoral ministry for several decades. He's not a date setter. He does not have a reputation for being one of these prophecy teachers that every week is filling in the latest news headline and tying it in with a verse in the Bible. Yet he got drawn into the story about this aged Jewish rabbi, an authority in Jewish mysticism, and a note released 1 year after his death allegedly revealing in a coded way that Yehoshua, Jesus, is the Messiah. He's written a book on it, The Rabbi Who Found Messiah. There's a DVD documentary with it. Pastor Gallup says that there are students of this deceased Rabbi Yitzchak Kaduri, and these students say that he did reveal to them that Yeshua was the Messiah. I'm going to go to the phones in one moment, but I shared this on the air some months back, but there is a man who was in an Orthodox Jewish yeshiva in another country, that's all I'll say, not in America. And the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of yeshiva, through Isaiah 53, led him to faith in Yeshua. This man is a Messianic Jew today, and he was led to faith by the head of the yeshiva. He said he's secretly in there as a witness. The fellow is a believer today. Carl, you said that you are hearing more and more accounts of ultra-Orthodox Jews who are secret believers in Yeshua. You probably came to it with hope, but with some skepticism. How convinced are you at this point?
How convinced am I of what? Of secret believers?
Yeah, that there are more and more these.
Oh, yes. Listen, I'm convinced of it. I mean, the New Testament, the first century, that was a case. I mean, Nicodemus seems to be a good example of that in John chapter 3, coming to Jesus at night and then, of course, taking the body of our Lord from the cross. But listen, yes, my film documents, my book documents, this reporting of secret believers. I, too, have many friends inside of Israel. I've been connected to Israel for many years. In various ways. I've got Orthodox Jewish friends. I have people who are born and raised there. I've got others that are from America but have lived in Israel for many, many years. All of these testify to me that over the years, many Jews have come to faith in Yeshua, Jesus, we would call him as Christ, as Messiah. Some are becoming a little public with it, but they take an awful lot of persecution. Many of them are just secret believers along these lines. I have a feeling.
Yeah, and again, we're talking about religious Jews, and there was one who was kidnapped from our home when we lived in Maryland, kidnapped from us in Maryland by his family as a secret believer. We know firsthand. And let me say this. Every counter-missionary rabbi I know, every ultra-Orthodox rabbi I know speaks against violent persecution of fellow Jews, speaks against kidnapping, deprogramming. So I am not indicting the Jewish community as a whole, religious Jews. But the fact is, this is the ultimate betrayal.
Yes.
To believe in this one, Jesus, who's considered to be the arch enemy of the Jewish people and the one who has brought untold suffering on Jews, to not just believe in him, but then to proselytize would be the ultimate crime if you are raised as a traditional Jew.
Right. And Dr. Brown, let me state, as you just did, neither am I indicting Jews or Orthodox Judaism. I have a 30-year track record, public track record, of being one of the greatest supporters of my cousins in the faith, Orthodox Jews, and the right of Israel to exist. To my own detriment, on the internet, I am castigated daily by people who hate Israel, who hate the Jews, and I defend them with every fiber of my being. It is my biblical duty to do so. So in writing this book, I'm not attacking Jews, I'm not attacking Judaism, I am saying that I'm writing this story, I'm reporting this story, and then, of course, using this as an opportunity to tell people about the prophetic days in which we live.
Absolutely. All right, let's go to Columbus, Ohio. Our friend Jason, thanks for calling the Line of Fire. What would you like to contribute to the discussion?
Well, first of all, thanks for taking my call. So I'd just like to bring up a YouTube video that I'm sure that the guest is, that Carl is familiar with Yad Ahim, and they basically say the exact opposite, and they have Rabbi Yehoshua Zigdon, Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zakai, who served as the rabbi's assistant for 10 years, Rabbi Michael Zituni, and he was the head of Nachala Yitzhak Yeshiva, and of course, and this is probably the most significant, Rabbi David Kaduri, the very son of Rabbi Yitzhak Kaduri. So the question would be, I get why you would think, you know, the MO would be for David Kaduri to do this, as you just spoke of, that Jews supposedly the only, you know, every fiber of Orthodox, you know, in my experience, I wouldn't say that's the antithesis 100% of Jewish thought. Converting to Islam would be just as any other religion other than Judaism. I wouldn't just single out Christians on that.
Your question for me, Jason?
The question would be, why do you think, and what, like, don't you think it's a little out of line to think that a few people who studied with Rabbi Kaduri, why would their claims hold more weight than Rabbi Kaduri's own son?
Well, let me answer that, Jason. Yes. Thank you. Listen, that's a wonderful question, a very fair question, and God bless you for asking it. Again, when you read my book and watch the movie, you'll get your answer in whole. I'm just giving snippets because a radio interview can only be done in 5 and 10 minute snippets before you have to go to commercial break. So you're not getting the whole story. The book gives the whole story, and I address your very question. I address everything you just said. And as a matter of fact, in my movie, we have film footage of the very people you're speaking of, including David Kaduri, including that organization Yes, we've got film footage of them. So even the movie is very objective. But let me just say this, Jason, in snippets. Again, please read the book. But let me say, it's more than just these two students. Remember, Israeli media sources reported for years prior to his proclamation of a note, his pronouncements of Messiah, Messiah's coming, get ready, Jews, come to Israel. Now, he didn't say the name was Yehoshua or Yeshua, but he spoke of Messiah, whereas David Kaduri, I've got him on film saying, my father never even spoke of Messiah. But we also know when Israel Today ran the story on the note, they also uncovered the fact that in Kaduri's own writings, he had drawn pictures of crosses, of all things, crosses all over his notes. And in the Orthodox Jewish world, the symbol of the cross is anathema. And they asked David Kaduri about it. And David Kaduri said, well, my father said these were revealed to him by angels. I mean, he's on record saying that. So David Kaduri says things, and these people that are, you know, that are defending David Kaduri, they say these things, but the facts don't back it up, Jason. The facts don't back it up. We've got the reports. We've got the investigative journalism done. We've got people on film from the yeshiva who've put their lives and legacies on the line, put on film, put all over the internet, now in a book and in a movie. We've got the Israeli media sources. We've got the crosses and David Kaduri talking about that. But here's the deal I want everybody to remember, that no one disputed this note until it was decoded and they saw that the name was Yeshua. Then they disputed it and said it's a hoax. Prior to that, they were quite proud to have it on the website. That's where I smell the rat. But now, remember, I also was in Florida law enforcement for 10 years as a deputy sheriff and criminal investigator before I was in ministry. So I come at this from kind of an investigation of evidence and what's fact and what's not, who says what and who doesn't say. And I'm telling you, even though I'm not this rabbi's apologist and I'm not jumping up and down proclaiming this is that, I'm saying from a journalistic standpoint, an investigative standpoint, the evidence seems to indicate that the note is authentic, and the rabbi's teaching is authentic. Now the world has to deal with it. Now, whether his prophecy is accurate about Ariel Sharon's death, that remains to be seen. But I know one thing. If he said that Jesus is Messiah and that was revealed to me, I know that that's a biblical fact. He was dead right about that, Dr. Brown.
Right, and regardless of whether he ever gave a prophecy, regardless of whether he ever wrote anything up and any of these things ever happened, what we're starting with what we know, namely that Yeshua is the Messiah of Israel. And then we have this expectation that God will be opening the eyes of Jewish people, these sincere Jews, many of them praying and longing for the coming of the Messiah, many of them whose lives put Christians to shame in many ways. We're very confident Yeshua will be revealed. Hey, Jason, I know you're a serious student. You heard a very serious answer. Look at that chronology. Was this denied, the existence of the note denied, only after it was decoded? Thanks for the call.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to the Line of Fire on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. As I come your way live from Dallas, Texas, my special guest, animated and excited about the subject, Pastor Carl Gallups, G-A-L-L-U-P-S, author of the book, The Rabbi Who Found Messiah. With the book is about a one-hour documentary DVD. I've not seen it yet. I've not read the book yet. I'm eager to, but I followed the situation so carefully. I was ready, Pastor, to have you on immediately, even before I got hold of the book. And, you know, I would love for the whole story to be true, simply because I expect this to be happening. More and more ultra-Orthodox Jews coming to faith in Jesus, Yeshua, the Messiah, and not then leaving and becoming Gentile Christians, but continuing to be devoted Jews, but now with a revelation of who the Messiah is. And the way this happened rings true in many ways. You've investigated it, so I'm so eager to see this and watch the DVD. But in the 2 or 3 minutes we have, give me a few. What were some of the most exciting things for you as you're doing this, not just as a pastor and a lover of the Word and a lover of Israel and a lover of Yeshua, but as an investigative journalist? What were some of the most exciting discoveries for you?
Well, the most exciting thing was to understand that, look, I'm telling this story. The story's out there. The facts are out there. They're well documented. So I'm telling the story. And Dr. Brown, as I'm telling it, as I'm writing it, I'm thinking, you know, regardless of whether this story is true, and to me, the facts point to the fact that it is a true story. But regardless, why should it surprise us, especially believers? Why should it surprise us if we are truly living in the last days? I mean, think about it. Israel's back in the land. The nations of Ezekiel 38 are lining up. The gospel's going to the world, on and on and on. This convergence of biblical prophecies, we're the only generation in the history of the world to be experiencing these things. If we're living in the last days, why should it surprise us that God might reach down, reveal himself, kind of like the Apostle Paul, that Jesus would reveal himself to the most revered rabbi? 300,000 people came to this man's funeral. They had to close the streets of Jerusalem down for 2 days. Millions of people around the world follow him. It would be just like God in the last days, one more time, to reach out to the Jews through the man they would listen to the most and say, Messiah is Yeshua. Messiah is Yeshua, and he's coming soon. It would also be like God to give a time marker with a man like Ariel Sharon, this iconic Israeli figure whom some people call the Savior of Israel and the Lion of God and the King of Israel. Now, whether or not God did that is up to the reader, and we shall see. But to me, Dr. Brown, it's just like God to do something like this in the last days. And that's what fired me up as I started unfolding this story.
Got it. All right, let me grab a couple of quick calls. And thank you again for the passion with which you have thrown yourself into this. Diana in Silver Spring, Maryland, our time is real short, so let's get right to your comment.
Okay, hi. I just wanted to know if you've heard Cynthia Nuwaru's article on Rapture Ready. Basically, she's saying that we need spiritual discernment because she said that there is an extended explanation of Baduri explaining to his students how to recognize the Messiah and that the Messiah will attach himself to another person and will bring peace. and that he will attach his, and he will not know that he's a Messiah. Have you heard of that article? I just wanted to know if it's true. I just don't
Yes, we're running out of time. Forgive me for interjecting. But, Diana, yes, I explore that in depth in my book. As I said, this is a very objective journalistic accounting, and I explore all of that in depth. And let me just say to you in a quick snippet, it would require that Christians understand the Jewish mindset of the two messiahs, Messiah ben Joseph, Messiah ben David, and I write about this extensively in my book, and what the Jew would be expecting concerning the Messiah. You got to remember, Kaduri was not a Baptist who wore a suit and sat behind stained glass windows. He was an Orthodox Jew who was describing to the Jews the coming of the Messiah. That's my quick snippet.
Wonderful quick snippet. Diana, thank you for the question.
Yes,
I do appreciate it. And all right, let's try this real quick. Stu in Rockville, time is real short, so dive right in, please.
My question to the author is, has he explored whether the rabbi changed his view as to what the Messiah was supposed to be? Not in the Jewish view, it's a human being going to be king of Israel, but not a son of God, not a divine being. The name is one thing, but the quality of Messiah was different.
Great question. Great question.
Well, again, I explore this in my book. I hate to keep giving that answer, but it's true.
No, no, no. You got it. You got to do it. That's why we have you on the air, too, so people can know about it.
But it's true. It's in my book. And again, Stu, the quick answer is it would require that you understand the Jewish mindset concerning the coming of Messiah. The bottom line is Kaduri proclaimed that Messiah, from his biblical and Jewish mindset, was Yeshua. But it was not, according to Kaduri, just as a result of his study. This revelation was a result of Messiah visiting him personally. That's what he said. Now, I don't know if that happened or not, but that was what he said.
Yeah, that's
and
his
that's
testimony.
What he taught, and that's what he left in the note. And again, that's what happened to Paul. That's why should we think that that couldn't happen again?
Yeah, especially to a rabbi of that stature. Hey, thank you for the great question. I appreciate it.
Yes, me too.
There is actually a movement in Israel with one Orthodox Jewish man who is trying to get Jews to accept Jesus Yeshua as Messiah, son of Joseph, and a suffering Messiah, and to get away the stain and the stench. And again, I just look at this as another step in the right direction. Listen, I am eager to get the book and to watch the DVD. And maybe what we can do is set up another time where I can encourage everyone who differs and has a question to call, and we can just feel that. This way I can have gotten all the material in front of me as well. But listen, when you get the host eager to get the book they're talking about, that means you've done a good job. So thank
well,
you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Brown. It's my honor.
All right. God bless you. Thanks so much. All right, friends, study, look at the evidence, present it, and come to your conclusions. That's what we're asking you to do. I know the claims against. I've heard excellent answers rebutting those claims. Now we've got to look at it together. By the way, on a totally different subject, there are a lot of folks who've been emailing and posting on Facebook saying, you know, we were really critical of you going on with Benny Hinn, but we watched the shows, and the shows are great. And what great eye-opening discussion of the Messiah and the Old Testament. I encourage you to watch the shows. We did 5 days of recording, four on Messiah in the Old Testament. So that's what's airing this week, those four. I won't be on all 5 days this week, but four straight days. Watch them. We have some of them linked on my website. So go to Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. Click on latest videos, and you'll be able to watch the first couple that are online already on YouTube. And I think you'll be blessed, regardless of your views of the larger subjects about Benny Hinn and me involved. I think you will be blessed. Remember to order your copy of Authentic Fire. In fact, you can go to Amazon right now and get the Authentic Fire book. You will find it to be an eye-opener and igniting fresh fire in your own heart. When you get it, email authenticfire@askdrbrown.org to get your free ebook with it. My bottom line today, God only knows what happened with Yitzhak Kaduri, but I have no question that he is opening the eyes of Orthodox Jews around the world. Well, what is Islam really? Is it the face of terrorism? Is it a peaceful religion? We'll find out as we talk to an expert.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, I am right now in Dallas, Texas, actually South Lake. And if my voice sounds a little clearer for all of my friends listening all over the Dallas-Fort Worth area, it's because I'm right in your neck of the woods. No, it's not going to affect the sound of the broadcast at all, obviously. But here we are. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. I'm at the King's University, which is now housed by Gateway Church, pastored by my friend Robert Morris. And I'm teaching three straight days, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. We start at 9 in the morning. We end at 6. So the first hour of the show is when the students are having lunch break. I am having the joy of speaking to you on the air. The second hour, this hour now, they are watching a video of a debate I did with a gay activist. And then after the show, I'll come in and talk with them. And we will interact together, do that again tomorrow. So we'll be doing live radio in the midst of these full days of teaching. What a joy to teach the word. What a joy to be on the radio with you. It's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, but we often talk about subjects that relate closely to Israel and the Jewish people. And one of those subjects is Islam. And I have a guest on the air with me, Dr. Mark Dury. He's a theologian, human rights activist, and Anglican pastor. And he is Shulman Ginsberg Fellow at the Middle East Forum and Adjunct Research Fellow of the Center for the Study of Islam and Other Faiths at Melbourne School of Theology. He has advanced degrees and has lectured as an academic, as a scholar, on the areas, different areas of Islam. He's written several books, The Third Choice, Which God, and others. And it's a delight to have Dr. Dury on the air with us. Dr. Dury, welcome to The Line of Fire. Thanks so much for joining us. Joey, I'm cutting in and out here on my screen, so if you could put the good doctor on the air with me, that would be great. Welcome to The Line of Fire, sir.
Great to be here with you. Thanks for having me.
Now, where are you right now as we speak?
I'm actually in on Capitol Hill in Washington. I've been speaking to members of Congress today.
Oh, all right. Well, boy, I was feeling terrible that we're waking you up in the middle of the night in Australia. How did you, let me just jump in with right what you said. How did you get this invitation to be speaking on Capitol Hill?
Well, I made a connection years ago with a friend, a dear friend, Bill Murray, who is working with the Religious Freedom Coalition. That was when I was presenting at a think tank here in Washington on religious freedom. And so I've been coming with him and talking to members of Congress about the priorities, really, for helping Americans be aware of the threats, the challenges that we face, and also particularly what to do about the persecution of Christians, particularly in Islamic countries.
Absolutely, an urgently important issue. And how is it, as a Christian, that you got so interested in academic study of Islam?
Well, before I became a pastor, I was, in fact, an academic in linguistics, and I did a PhD on the language of people in Aceh in Indonesia, which is one of the more Muslim groups in Indonesia. That was in the early 80s. So after 9/11, I, having had that background of living and working amongst some Muslim people, who had, by the way, a strong history of jihad, I realized I needed to use that knowledge and extend it. So I've been working at that for the past 13 years, and now I'm really about half-time equipping the church, training people to understand and respond to Islam.
All right. When we come back, here are the important questions I want us to explore with our listeners. And if you have a question for my guest, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. What is Islam really? Is it the face of jihadist terror? Is it a more peaceful religion? Which is the real Islam, and is it a real threat? And what about the persecution of Christians?
Fire we want, for fire we plead. Send the fire. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much for joining us on The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. My guest, Dr. Mark Dury, an expert on Islam. Dr. Dury, for those who don't know you and for those who are always questioning and a little skeptical in our listening audience, what is your academic background? You know, we often hear about people being expert in certain areas and they only have a superficial knowledge of the subject. So what is your academic background and the study you have invested in this?
Well, I did my first PhD in linguistics and taught at a number of and did research at a number of universities, including Stanford, MIT, UCLA, and then was in Melbourne for a number of years. I went into work as a cleric, as a pastor, and trained in theology. And since for the last 12 years, I've written three books on Islam. I'm actually doing a second doctorate of theology at the moment on the origins of Islam. And have been speaking extensively in recent years. So that's my background.
Yeah, and anyone who starts the sentence with "my first PhD was in thus and such" has my respect. All right, let me ask some broad questions, and then we can get more and more specific. And again, this is your perspective, but you interact with lots of folks. I'm sure you've interacted with Islamic scholars and devout Muslims as well. The real Islam, and let me give you my perspective. If I look at authentic Judaism, I do not look at conservative or reform Judaism, which barely keeps the commandments and some don't even believe in a coming Messiah and question the veracity of the Torah and things like that. I would look at a much more orthodox form, not fully ultra-Orthodox in every way, and I'm not saying that that's the way it's been for thousands of years, but authentic Judaism is going to take the text more seriously, and the Jews are observing the Sabbath and the dietary laws and praying certain ways every day and so on. Authentic Islam, as you understand it, the way it would have been practiced a thousand years ago, the religion that ultimately was birthed in the centuries following Muhammad, what does that look like today? Which is it the Taliban expression? Is it some moderate Muslim in the West? What does it look like?
Well, here's Islam in a nutshell. The theory of Islam is that human beings need guidance. Muhammad was sent as a guide, and he was given the Quran, which has teachings, but also his life is the perfect guide. So if you imitate him and do what he did, then you are rightly guided, and you're like an obedient slave in Allah's house, and Allah will be pleased with you. And Islam promises success to those who are rightly guided. So the real question is, who was Muhammad? What did he do, and how did he live? And I think that it's absolutely clear that the radical forms that Islam, say, is practiced in Saudi Arabia, strict Sharia law, yes, military jihad, these conform quite closely to the example and the teaching of Muhammad. So if Orthodox Jews are the actual bearers of the future for rabbinical Judaism, because they have that faith and that momentum, it's very radical Islam that is the authentic representation of the teachings of Muhammad. For example, Muhammad said, if you find a Jew, kill him. And he said, I've been victorious through terror. And he commanded in the Quran to fight against the unbelievers. He commanded cutting off the hands of thieves and stoning of adulterers. So all the things that people find disturbing and repugnant about manifestations of Islam, they actually do go back to the example and the teaching of Muhammad, and that's the problem.
And he is the perfect man. He is the model. He's not looked at by Muslims the same way that Christians would look at Jesus, but he is the perfect man and the model. Let me ask you something very specific, then I want to get to larger questions as we pursue this. The issue of beheading that we see now, one of the most horrific things imaginable, and you'll see someone, their head chopped, well, not even chopped off, just slowly sawed off with sometimes barely a pocket knife as the crowds around shout, Allahu Akbar. Is there any connection with Muhammad himself and the act of beheading?
Yes, he beheaded a whole Jewish tribe in Medina 700 or 800 men. That was the last remnants of the Jews in Medina. The Quran says when you when you're coming against the infidel or those that oppose Muhammad, you should strike them on the neck. It's cutting the neck, it's called in Arabic. And actually, non-Muslims living under Islam, many Islamic textbooks speak about them as being people who have to redeem their heads once a year. And the ritual of a non-Muslim, a Jew or a Christian living under Islam and paying a tax each year, they were the traditional ritual was that you'd be struck a blow on the neck to symbolize your beheading if you broke any of the rules of submission to Islam. So beheading, striking on the neck, cutting the throat, this is all regarded as the same thing, is a core part of the practice of Muhammad and also the testimony of the Quran.
Got it. So this is not just some weird thing that a few folks picked up. There is a tradition and history with it. Now, we all know the word shalom, the equivalent in Arabic, of course, salam. Is there for the meaning of Islam the religion of peace, or does it mean with that particular form of the word the religion of submission to Allah? Does Islam mean submission primarily or peace primarily?
Well, the root in Arabic is SLM, so in salam, it does mean peace, but the form of the verb or the form of the word that's used in Islam is a derivative which means to be submissive. So it means to surrender. So it's the peace of someone that's been subdued. So Islam actually means submission or surrender, and Muslim means a submitter. So sometimes people say, oh, Islam means peace. That's not true. Salam means peace. Islam means surrender or submission. It's what an enemy does when they lay down their weapons and they lie down and they give you their head to cut off or to allow them to keep it if you want it.
Exactly. And now let's think of one other thing. Christians want to spread the gospel around the world. The Great Commission, go into all the world, make disciples. Muslims want to spread their message around the world. And yet there's an aspect of it of dominance in Islam, of taking over. In your view, and again, there are different groups of Christians, different philosophies, but the general mission's mandate to take the good news of Jesus all around the world, what's different between that and the Muslim view of spreading Islam around the world? What looks different or has a different end result between those?
The Islamic view is very much based on calling people to Islam. And Muhammad said to give non-believers three choices. One was to surrender to Islam. Another is to fight, that's the sword, or to be politically submissive. So you agree to live under Islamic rule, but keeping your faith. So the origins of the idea of spreading Islam involves this choice of basically convert, surrender, or death. So that's completely different from the Christian understanding of just preaching a message.
And with that as well, the whole aspect of Sharia law, then, that there is a legal system that comes with it, brings different results, because if enough Muslims dominate a society, they now have a legal system that they want to oppose, as opposed to turning people to the Lord, who now have a changed life and live differently. And what about this quote I read once, that in Islam, religion is not a part of life, but life is part of religion. Does that sound accurate to you?
I think that's true. The word religion in Islam means something like sovereignty, and it's the totality of everything. Muhammad was a general. He was also the chief justice. He was also the president. He was also the high priest. So Islam doesn't make a distinction between religion and politics. It's all one. So the goal of Islamic mission is to establish an Islamic order, a rightly guided society in which Sharia law is the law of the land, and everyone has to accept that and to agree to live under the authority. The Quran says that Islam has been, Muhammad was sent so that he would triumph over all other religions. So there's an expectation of political and military triumph.
Right. And then, of course, once there is any type of a conflict, say with Iran and Iraq, even though Iran was the more religious of the countries, they both posed it as a holy war against one another. And say you may have evangelical Christians who are in the military and they may feel they're doing the right thing by fighting against the Taliban in Afghanistan. But from the viewpoint of the Taliban, it would be very different than the viewpoint of the West. My guest, Dr. Mark Gurry, we've been wanting to have him on for some weeks now, and so pleased that as he's here in D.C. educating our lawmakers, our legislators, about what's happening with Islam and the persecutions of Christians worldwide, an expert in Islam and very much on the front lines of standing up for persecuted Christians around the world. We'll be back with much more from Dr. Mark Gurry. We'll find out how to be in touch with him and his materials. And if you have a call, I will be taking calls beginning the next segment, 866-34-TRUTH, on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, focusing on Islam.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us, friends, on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday as I come your way live from Dallas, Texas, teaching an all-day course for 3 days at the King's University. And in the midst of the day, was working out schedule to do 2 hours of live radio and then leave here and go back to teaching. I'm thrilled to have on the air with me Dr. Mark Gurry, an expert in Islam and a man deeply concerned about the persecution of Christians in the Middle East and other parts of the world, the great majority of this coming from the hand of Muslims. Sir, should we use the phrase radical Islam or radical Muslims when we talk about Taliban, when we talk about Muslim Brotherhood, when we talk about Hamas or these other groups, when we talk about Hezbollah and on the list goes? Should we call them radical Muslims and describe this as radical Islam so as to separate it from Islam as a whole? Or is that a mistake to do? Is that giving a false impression of Islam?
Certainly, I think in Arabic, there's just Islam. I mean, there isn't such a thing as extreme Islam and moderate Islam. And we sort of have this belief that moderate Islam is all right, but extreme Islam is not. I mean, whoever asked for a moderate brain surgeon, you know, Islam is just Islam. Personally, I don't mind the word radical because it implies the root. You know, the radical means the root. That's what it comes from. So this is, to me, a radical means authentic. It means, you know, the essence of Islam. But, yeah, I think those, the Taliban and others, they are Muslims. They're acting with an Islamic worldview. And one of the things also, however, is that Muslims do vary quite a lot around the world. They apply their Islam in many different ways, so that should be acknowledged. But I don't think there is any such thing as extreme Islam or fundamentalist Islam. It is just Islam, really.
All right. So on that score, let me just ask a more politically charged question. I'm a Jewish believer in Jesus. I believe scripturally that it is a divine return that Jewish people have been brought back to the land sovereignly, and that while all issues must be addressed fairly, the issues of the Palestinians and other disputes must be addressed fairly, and while Israel has plenty of issues with it, I myself would be called a Zionist or pro-Israel. You may have a different perspective, but that's secondary to the larger discussion here. There is the view that what we see around the world in terms of Islamic violence and terrorism is specifically a reaction to the dispute over the land of Palestine, the land of Israel, that you did not see this type of Islam in previous centuries, and that this is really just a political manifestation and it's a response to Western colonialism. Others like Professor John Philip Jenkins in his book on the lost history of Christianity would say, no, probably about 800 years ago, violent Islam wiped out much of Christianity in Asia, the Middle East, Northern Africa. Your take, again, as an expert on this subject from many different angles, how would you respond to that?
I think violent and aggressive jihad has always been incredibly traumatic and destructive. The conquest of India was devastating and vast destruction. When Ethiopia was conquered, I think in the 16th or 17th century, the slave market was flooded all the way to India with slaves that were taken by Muslims there. Whole cities and large populations were wiped out in the conquest of the Middle East. Islamic conquest is always incredibly traumatic and has caused vast losses of life throughout history. There is nothing new about contemporary ideological manifestations of aggressive militaristic Islam. It's only the weapons that have changed. The outlook is exactly the same.
Yeah, and as I've studied and looked at things, that's been my perspective as well. You've looked at them much more carefully. There is a Quranic phrase of someone dying sabilillahi in the path of Allah. That can basically just mean in warfare, if it is considered holy war, if it is Muslims fighting non-Muslims, this can now be the path of Allah and thus some assurance of salvation. For the most devoted Muslim, he follows the pillars of Islam. He's made the Hajj. He fasts during Ramadan. He gives of his income. He prays five times a day. He makes his confession and so on. Does that person have an assurance of salvation, forgiveness? He confesses Allah is Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim, the merciful and compassionate, on and on through the day. Does he have any assurance of salvation, or is there something he has to do to get assurance?
There is no guarantee of being accepted by Allah. Muhammad, even in the Quran, says that he doesn't know what will happen to him. The exception is if you die fighting the infidels in holy war, then you have a guaranteed kind of direct pass, a free ticket to get into paradise. So that is a huge incentive for pious Muslims. And indeed, in Islam, no warfare is allowed unless it's religious. Like, you're supposed, every war is meant to be a religious war, so theoretically everyone who dies in war should be a martyr if they're fighting on the right side. So that's a core part. This is a core part of Islamic theology and has been since the very beginning.
So whereas the Crusades are a complete aberration, and there are a lot of dimensions to it, but the Crusades are an aberration to Christian history, warfare in the name of Allah is part and parcel of Islam, correct?
That's true. In Christian tradition, the emperor wields the sword for the common good, so you could argue there's a place for the military to protect the state and so on. But that's not a religious war. That's maybe a just war, perhaps, you hope. It's not a religious war. But in Islam, all warfare is religious. So everything is holy war. And that's, as I said, central to Muhammad's practice. And there are many, many verses in the Quran exhorting Muslims to go on military warfare in the path of Allah, vis-a-vis Allah.
And studying Quran, it's not easy to say which comes first, which comes last. I mean, there's the order in which allegedly the revelation was received, but it's not like going from Old Testament to New. And you can say, okay, in the days of Joshua, they took the land, but Jesus tells his disciples to put down the sword. You don't really have that chronology to help you in Quran. All right, we've got a half hour more. I so appreciate you taking the time, especially in a busy schedule in the States. How can folks find out more about your work and get your materials?
I have a website, markdurie.com, and there's a lot of resources there, videos, audios, and my three books, The Third Choice, Which God, that's about whether we worship the same God, and Liberty to the Captives, they can all be, you can find links on the site to that and other resources.
Excellent. All right, we come back. I want to ask my guest a few questions. I want to find out, do Muslims relate to God as Father? And who is Jesus to Muslims? What's the life of a Muslim like? Just to try to get into their shoes and understand them better. What can we do to reach Muslims with the gospel? And then what about the persecution of Christians? Boy, I said I was going to take a call or calls in the last segment. I haven't, but hang on. I do want to get to some calls in the next half hour. Visit Dr. Drury's website. And I want to encourage you strongly. Join me in Israel May 20th to 30th, the first tour I'm ever leading to Israel. You'll learn a whole lot about Islam. You'll see things from a different angle being there as well. Go to my website right now, askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. Sign up for the Israel tour today. The clock is ticking. May's coming very soon.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, it is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, and sometimes we'll talk about Islam on a Thursday, being a sister religion in many ways to Judaism, being something that was birthed by a Semitic people in the Middle East, and being something that is lived out right now in the Middle East in front of our eyes, and of course spreading around the world to the point that in some major European cities, the number one boy's name is Muhammad. Something to think about as the Islamic population is perhaps 1.6 million billion worldwide, and professing Christian population perhaps 2.2 billion. And this has been something that would have been unthinkable at the turn of the 20th century. 866-34-TRUTH. I am joined by my special guest, Dr. Mark Dury, who is an expert in Islam and has focused now especially on the persecution of Christians by Muslims. The suffering is staggering, and sometimes I wonder how we can just go about living our normal lives in light of the suffering that so many are enduring, and we'll talk about that in a moment. Dr. Dury, there are many different names for Allah in Arabic. In my 3 years of classical Arabic, I remember hearing the joke that just about any word, you know, good, strong, powerful, you had Arabic, became a title for Allah. He is many different things, the 99 names of Allah and so on. Is one of those names Father?
No, it's not. In fact, Muslim theologians have explained that it's forbidden to call God Father.
So what does that tell us then? You've got folks, hundreds of millions, who actually pray five times a day, and they'll fast devotedly, feast at night, but fast from dawn to dusk, no liquid, no food during Ramadan, a lot of devotion. I mean, crowds can be stirred if there was the accusation that someone insulted Muhammad. Very, very sincere religious people, and yet they don't relate to God as Father. How does a Muslim relate to Allah?
The image that the Quran and Muhammad gave was that of a master and a slave. So we are the slaves, and he is the slave owner. So our response to Allah is to obey his will. This is not based on a covenantal relationship. It's not based on a relationship of love. It's based on a relationship of submission and obedience. So Allah is not, Allah of the Quran is not personal and is not relational, is not covenantal, but it's rather the encounter with absolute will. That's really the encounter you have with Allah.
All right. So believers, followers of Jesus, on the one hand, we would say, use the word doulos, we are slaves, we are bond servants of the Lord. And I would say that vocationally we are servants, but relationally we are sons and daughters. So when a Muslim refers to Allah as merciful and compassionate, or one Quranic verse, or others refer to him as Tawab, off-relenting and forgiving, it's a totally different concept than what the Christian understands about forgiveness through the cross, isn't it?
It is indeed. And the God of the Quran is transcendent and distinct from, rather than personal. In the Bible, God's always showing up. He's walking in the Garden of Eden. He's present with the people of Israel. He's there in the temple. The Holy Spirit is present in his people, walks among us in Christ. But the God of the Quran is quite separate, completely above and beyond us, to be feared. One Muslim commentator said if every single human being ended up in hell, it wouldn't make any difference to God. You know, he's completely separate from us in a relational sense.
Extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. Which to me gives me all the more heart to reach Muslims with the good news of Jesus. Think of turning that zeal into a relationship where you know you're loved and you know you're accepted and you know you're forgiven. If you're listening, Muslim or non-Muslim, that forgiveness is yours through the cross, where you can now live for God as a place of acceptance.
Sing it, Lord.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for being part of our broadcast today, 866-34-TRUTH. My joy to be with you on The Line of Fire. My special guest, Dr. Mark Dury, an expert in Islam. We're going to talk in a moment about the persecution of Christians. If you have a question, 866-34-TRUTH. Milano in Largo, Florida, you've been holding for some time with a question for my guest. So thanks for holding and welcome to The Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. You stole a little bit of my thunder because you're such a great interviewer. Basically, I guess, I talk to Muslims quite a bit and people who are empathetic towards Islam and stuff like that. And I've listened to a lot of people in my lifetime, studied a little bit of Islam. I'm not an expert, but I do have a question. If, how can I put this? If I was a Muslim, say, and I went to a mosque around the world, and I went to another mosque in the United States, am I taught to, if an infidel doesn't convert, that I should eliminate them? I know you had you kind of talked about that, but I just want to get to the point. Do I need to be taken off the face of the earth because I'm not following the ways of Islam?
All right, so let's just say you've got a serious Muslim, takes their faith seriously, Dr. Dury, and they're bringing the message of Islam and people do not receive it. What's the answer to Milano's question?
Well, firstly, people will teach very different things in different mosques, so just be aware of that. I think churches are a bit like that as well. But there is a traditional core teaching in Islam that the blood of a non-Muslim is halal. That is, it's permissible to take it, unless it's protected. So the default state is the non-Muslim can be killed. If, however, they've surrendered to Islamic order and live in an Islamic society, their blood is protected. And there are certainly, even in the West, Muslims who teach this. They might say, because Muslims are protected in America, therefore the blood of Christians in America is protected. But the default is they can be killed. So that is one reason why Christians are five times more likely to have become refugees in Iraq and Syria. Because when there's conflict going on, there are Muslims who believe that it is not a sin to take the life of an infidel. That's definitely something that Muhammad taught.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for the answer. Appreciate that. All right. Paint a picture for me, Dr. Dury, of what is happening with our brothers and sisters, be it in Egypt, be it in Syria, be it in Pakistan, be it in Iran, be it in Nigeria. What is actually happening with Islamic persecution of Christians? You were testifying on Capitol Hill today to our legislators in Washington, D.C. Really, how bad is it?
Well, it is very bad. What you need to understand is that, or what we do need to understand is that Islam's plan for Christians is that they should surrender and live under Islamic rules submissively and accepting a whole lot of disabilities, including, for example, their testimony is not valid in court, they pay taxes to the Muslim community, and so on. Now, if they're not doing that, according to those who follow a strict or more radical view of Islam, if they're not surrendered, paying the tax and submissive, then they have no protection of their life and their property. So those Muslims who want to implement an Islamic order believe it's not there and that Christians are not protected because they're not only not surrendering, but they're lobbying politically for equality for all people, they're lobbying against Sharia. They believe that it's permissible to kill Christians. So that's why you've had many Coptic Christians killed. And in northern Nigeria, Boko Haram, which is a terrorist radical Islamic organization, has killed thousands of Christians in recent years. And they don't consider it a sin to do so. Also, when Muslims fight each other, like Shiites against Sunnis, this has been happening in Iraq and Syria, typically, Christians who don't carry arms, they're not really permitted to in Islam, they become like meat in a sandwich. They get attacked by all sides. And so the Christians in Iraq have more than 80% of the Christians in Iraq have fled the country. And in both in Iraq and Syria, Christians are five times more likely than Muslims to become refugees. This has always been the case down through history. In fact, the Crusades began because there'd been conflicts between Muslims and Christians who were being killed in those conflicts. So it's a very, very old story. I think it's not impossible that Christianity could disappear in some of those countries in the Middle East. And certainly the catastrophic decline of Christian populations has been very disturbing. It's also, just got to add this, that it's disturbing that in some cases American foreign policy or military policy has been the trigger that's made life worse for Christians. So there's responsibility, really, for the U.S. to really take care of these people whose condition it has made much worse.
One of my friends, Pat Mahoney, is D.C.-based. He has been in dialogue with Iranian leaders concerning persecution of Christians in Iran, in particular one pastor, American-Iranian pastor, whose case is before the public here a lot. But he said that he met with American leaders before our invasion of Iraq, and he asked what was the strategy in terms of the Christian population there and the exit plan in terms of the Christian population. And according to Reverend Mahoney, and he said it on the air here, they looked at him as if they had no clue what the question was even about. It's a disaster right now. And yes, I do agree that there's American culpability. Many of our soldiers have sacrificed, many families sacrificed. The goals were certainly good goals. I don't believe we went in there just out of oil greed or anything like that. And yet, sure, there seemed to be very little consideration of what the results were going to be for the Christian population. So if we just focus on Iraq, be totally candid with us, sir. How is there American culpability? What did we do wrong? What did we open up with what we did in Iraq and the removal of Saddam Hussein?
Saddam Hussein protected non-Muslim minorities. It was in his interest to keep them safe, really. They supported him, in effect, because they were less threatened. And the groups that fought against him, the jihadis, whenever someone adopts the jihadi worldview, like they're going to fight against Americans or against each other, they are buying into the idea that they have permission to kill infidels or permission to kill those who are not true to Islam. So once you create jihad conditions, conflict conditions, Christians suddenly become incredibly vulnerable. Also, they get because of American presence, European presence, they get identified with the infidels, with these invaders. So they get attacked as a kind of proxy for attacking Americans. And their loyalty comes into question as well. I think it's absolutely true that the Allies there had no plan for protecting Christians. They had no concept of how dangerous it would be for Christians. Also, they're a soft target, really, for these jihadis, and they want to intimidate them and make them to kind of come under the thumb of their radical goals so that they will not provide any resistance to them. So it's a perfect storm of a whole combination of factors that has proved very destructive for the Christians of Iraq. I think at the very least, there should have been an intentional strategy of providing a safe haven for Christians who needed to flee.
Yeah, and again, honestly, when I was looking at the war and feeling that our reasons for going in are justified, and again, all respect to all of Americans and other nationalities that have sacrificed, that have lost loved ones, that have been wounded, and we always hear reports of others who've been greatly helped by what American soldiers have done and allies have done. I had not thought this through myself, and I'm no expert in the area, and I'm certainly no military or strategic expert, but I had not thought about what about the Christians. You see what's happened. We've only got a minute and a half before this break. What about Syria? Can you give us a concise overview on Syria, and is there a side we should be on?
Syria is a war between the Shiites, on the one hand, who Assad is aligning himself with, including Iran and Hezbollah, and the radical Sunnis, who are supported by Saudi Arabia. The underlying great struggle is between the Saudis and the Sunnis on the one hand, and there's a few different groups there, and the Shiites, Iran, on the other. So they're fighting it out in Syria. Assad is protecting Christians. The Sunni rebels, who are supported by the United States, are killing them. And so the Christians in Syria are really only safe in government-controlled areas. They look to Putin, who's supporting the Syrians, and to Assad for protection. They believe the Americans have abandoned them, and they can't understand why that's happening.
Oh, it's a terribly painful situation, and again, a tremendous amount of suffering. We're not talking about hundreds. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of people affected in Syria and other nations. When we come back, my guest, Dr. Mark Dury, I want to ask him some simple questions about our Christian witness to Muslims. Who is Jesus to the Muslim people? And what can we do as Islam spreads around the world, and especially five and under? There's a vast majority of young people born in the Muslim world. How can we reach them with the good news of Jesus?
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Very, very striking. In England and Wales, almost one-tenth of babies and toddlers born are Muslim. Age five and under is double the number of percentage population. Those that are much older, those that are 85 and older, it's 1 in 200 are Muslim. The general population of now babies being born around 1 in 10. And demographically for the whole population, 5 years old and younger, it's twice as high. That's the high birth rate affecting the UK, just another way for the expansion of Islam. So Dr. Mark Dury, my guest, again, please tell our listeners how they can get more of your material and how they can find out more about your work.
My website, Mark Dury, markdurie.com, has links to audios and videos, and there's also the three books, The Third Choice, Which God, and Liberty to the Captive. They can read about them there and order them.
Great. And I've been to the website and thrilled to see the material that's there and the work that you're doing. In Islam, there is a belief in Jesus. He is considered to be important, but of course he's not the Son of God, and is generally understood he wasn't crucified. How is he viewed, and is there a way to take the way he's viewed in Islam and use that as part of our witness to the Muslim world?
There's good news and bad news. The good news is that he's regarded as perfect, as someone who had great authority and power from God. He's highly regarded as peaceful and sort of a generous figure compared to Muhammad, who was militaristic. The bad news is that Islam teaches that he, in fact, all the prophets like Moses and Abraham and so on, were Muslim prophets. And when Jesus comes back, he will destroy Christianity, the Muslim Jesus, and institute Sharia law for the whole world. He will kill people who don't basically follow the example and teaching of Muhammad. But the end times, right. Jesus is pretty harsh.
Right. So then what should we not do in sharing the gospel with Muslims, and what should we do? Obviously, you could talk about this for hours, but just the short version, what should we not do? What should we do?
Don't be resistant. Don't hold back. I think what Muslims need to know is that they can have a personal relationship with God through Jesus. They need to know that if they don't understand the personal nature of God, they'll have a lot of trouble understanding the gospel. So that's the first step, is to ask, who is God? Is he holy? How do you understand God? They need to have a longing, need to be invited to have a personal encounter with Christ. Jesus is revealing himself through visions and dreams to many, many Muslims. And in our own church, we've baptized more than 50 Muslims in this last, former Muslims in the past year. And mm-hmm. particularly, for example, among some people groups, God is already reaping an amazing harvest. So Iranians, hundreds of thousands of Iranians have become Christians. And that's just going to, I think that'll happen more, because as people see the failure of the radical Islamic solution to the world's problems, they'll begin to say, well, maybe there's something else. Maybe Islam is not the solution. Maybe it's the problem. So these are really exciting times to be engaged in witnessing to Muslims. But above all, don't be afraid. Be bold. And just speak about your relationship with God. Don't insult Muhammad. There's lots of bad things about Muhammad, but that's not a fruitful track to go down with most people. Talk about your personal relationship with God.
Right. So in point of fact, it's not a matter of cowardice that we don't insult Muhammad. It's counterproductive.
It is counterproductive. It's like triggering off something. It's like pressing someone's buttons. There will be some people, former Muslims, people wanting to leave Islam, who understand about Muhammad and are happy to talk about it. But for many people, it can trigger them. And Islam is, one of the principles in Islam is taking offense, feeling victimized. Muhammad did that a lot. So it's not all that helpful for many to go in with aggressive rhetoric and trying to prove people wrong. It's better to bless the light than curse the darkness when you're relating to Muslims.
Absolutely. Of course, that's a generally great principle in ministry, but very specifically here. And John in Dayton, Ohio, would like to know, should Christians worry if they're living around devout Muslims, because there are more and more Muslims in America, and then some communities are much more religious, should they worry about this? They hear about what's happening in other parts of the world. What should their attitude be here in America?
I think it is a concern. If Islam became dominant, then there would be a pressure for Sharia law, and that would mean non-Muslims would become second-class citizens. It always happens. There's no exception to a society which has a Muslim majority, which doesn't discriminate in some way against non-Muslims. I think it's important to insist that with Muslims on the principles of reciprocity, of equality between people, we shouldn't make concessions to Sharia courts, to Sharia law, Sharia-compliant zones in our society. We should insist on treating Muslims as equal before the law. So that's a really powerful and important principle.
Right. All right. Thank you, John, for the question. I just didn't bring you on the air for shortness of time. Mark, you are talking to you, it's self-evident, the fact that you're testifying before legislators at Capitol Hill further adds to your credentials. The places where you've taught further adds to the credentials. You're not just some hyped-up Christian who saw on the Internet somewhere that Muslims are having visions of Jesus. You were there in the thick of it. You know people in the trenches, so to say, in different parts of the world, Muslim world, missionaries and others. And you are saying the same thing that everyone's saying. Some of my missions friends working in Europe, where there are a lot of Muslim refugees from Iran and other countries, they're shocked. They've never seen anything like it. They said, we've worked for decades trying to reach Muslims, and now they're flocking in. And of course, many of them, because of their background, are fearless witnesses, and they're willing to give their lives for Jesus. Are you seeing the same kind of extraordinary boldness to these Muslim converts?
Now, that's true. Look, there's always some that are insincere, but the ones that are sincere are amazing. I've never seen such hunger, and I've never seen so many miracles in answers to prayers as we see in their lives. Just week after week, every week there's people wanting to give their lives to Jesus, and such passion. My greatest concern is the church won't be ready to respond to this hunger and this need. I think it's happened in Iran because they've had more than 30 years of Islam and they know it back to front. And it's so easy for them to turn away from it. It will happen. It's harder for the Arabs, but it will happen in the Arab world as well. And our challenge is to be ready to respond to this harvest. It's like the sower is over. Is the harvesting is overtaking the sowing. You know, that's the phrase.
Yes, exactly.
It's just happening rapidly there.
It is remarkable. We are out of time, but thank you for joining us. We've been enriched, but what you have to say, we'll be enriched by reading your books and articles. And may the Lord use you as you testify and wake up our nation to the plight of Christians worldwide. Thank you so much, Dr. Dury.
What a pleasure, Dr. Brown. Thank you for having me.
All right, friends. Boy, if you listen to the first hour, ultra-Orthodox Jews coming to faith. Is it happening? Now, Muslims around the world coming to faith. God's at work. Harvest time. Let's get ready. Let's thrust our sickle in and let's reach out with love. Friends, sign up for the Israel Tour. Ask drbrown.org. My bottom line, it is harvest time. Let's get our hands dirty.